Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into something really core to how we operate, you know, our sense of self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
And we're tackling this head-on in Chapter 4 of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear, which is Self-Worth, the Quest for Respect.
Such a good chapter.
Everyone wants respect, right? This book kind of frames things in a, well, a unique way, right? Talking about human behavior through the lens of energy.
Emotional energy, specifically.
Yeah.
And how it all falls somewhere on this spectrum from love to fear.
Yeah, and the chapter kicks off with some helpful definitions. It talks about self-worth. Simple enough, right? It's the value we place on ourselves, that inherent feeling.
Okay. And then there's social value.
Which is the value placed on us by others. Or, more accurately, what we perceive that value to be.
Ah, okay. So that's the crucial link the book makes right on page one, isn't it? Our self-worth, that internal feeling, isn't necessarily tied to our actual social value.
Right. Not tied to objective facts about us or what people genuinely secretly think.
It's tied to our perception of our social value. How much we think we measure up to what we think others find pleasing or valuable.
Whatever we think will get us that nod of approval.
Because subconsciously we're chasing that feeling of self-worth. And we've learned, or we perceive, that gaining social value is the way to get it.
This is often subconscious, right? This whole system we use to value each other.
Very much so. We're not usually sitting there making like a logical checklist about someone's social value. It happens fast, often beneath conscious thought.
And the same goes for anticipating our value in the eyes of others.
Yep. Also largely subconscious. It can bypass our critical thinking.
Like we're all players in a game we don't even realize we're playing.
I think that's a good analogy.
And there's that interesting side note in the text, even if someone totally disconnects, lives alone.
Oh, right. The hermit example, sort of.
They still find value in something. Maybe it's nature, maybe animals, maybe just their own code. And they still look for patterns, try to fit in or gain acceptance within that context, whatever it is.
So it's inescapable, this drive. It just shifts its focus.
Like it's baked into being human, this need for social value. So we're all kind of stuck in this competition, even if we don't want to be.
Yeah, the chapter brings up social identity theory here.
How we see ourselves based on our groups.
Exactly, and our status in those groups. Think about that that line study they mentioned.
The visual one, with the lengths of lines.
Yeah, that one. Over 75% of people went along with the obviously wrong answer just because the group did.
Wow. That's a powerful pull.
It really shows how strong that subconscious drive to fit in, to gain that social approval, can be. We learn conformity pays off, socially speaking.
We learn that early. Think about schools, right?
Oh, yeah. The right clothes, the right music. Like political leaders.
Okay, yeah.
They might be amazing at winning popularity contests, but they might actually lack, you know, real leadership qualities.
Are they really leaders, or are they just incredibly good at reflecting what they think people want to see? Followers, in a way.
It's a provocative question, isn't it? If you get power by being popular, by reflecting perceived desires, are you leading with your own vision or just mirroring?
Exactly.
It raises questions about authenticity, doesn't it? If you're always a mirror, where are you?
Food for thought. So we learn to conform first. And then the chapter suggests we might move towards seeking like an alpha role, trying to be seen as superior somehow.
That's the progression it outlines. First fit in, then maybe try to stand out on top. The book talks about a warlike mentality emerging from this.
Yeah, if we perceive someone else's success as making us look bad, making us seem less valuable by comparison.
Our subconscious anticipates a drop in our own social value.
And the reaction, often unconscious, is to try and steal social value from them, usually by diminishing their perceived worth somehow, putting them down, finding fault.
Yeah, like a zero-sum game.
And it emphasizes this isn't just game playing. It causes real psychological harm. It mentions that study on monkeys, where lower rank in the group correlated with lower dopamine levels. That feeling of being devalued hits hard, biologically even.
Which leads into a really important warning the source gives us.
If perceived social value becomes the only thing propping up our self-worth, that's a dangerous place to be.
It makes us vulnerable, and it can actually push us towards manipulative habits.
Like trying to make others dependent on us for validation, so they need our approval to feel okay. That tactic of isolating someone, making yourself their only source of worth by tearing down their other connections.
Super manipulative.
Really toxic stuff.
Or even worse, actively sabotaging someone else's sources of self-worth, so they can't feel good independently.
Wow. And the chapter connects this directly to something like advertising.
Yeah, it's a prime example. Advertising often works by trying to shift our perception of what grants social value, making us feel like we're lacking something.
So we'll buy the product to fix that perceived inadequacy. It taps right into that subconscious quest for external validation.
The source uses that striking quote, "It isn't about being poor, it is about feeling poor," which really highlights how manipulating perception drives behavior.
Even if we think we're ignoring it.
Yeah, the research cited, like the Custer's and Art study, talks about how repetition and linking products to positive cues can build this sort of unconscious will that shapes our desires without us even realizing it.
Like the soda commercial example in the source, it creates an association, even if you weren't paying close attention.
Driving that cycle of seeking external fixes for an internal feeling.
Man, that's quite a system influencing us. So we're drawn to people who might boost our value, and we avoid those who threaten it.
Yeah, associating with someone famous to sort of bask in their reflected glory. The chapter calls it scavenging social value.
Scavenging. Not exactly a long-term strategy.
No, probably not sustainable for genuine self-worth.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Where do you, listening right now, where do you look for that validation? What do you think earns you respect in those circles?
And this leads to a really key takeaway in the chapter.
Which is?
That the people who earn the most real, lasting social value aren't the dominators or the scavengers. They're the ones who actually help other people generate their own value.
Hold on a second. Are we talking like straight up cooperation here? Because that goes against everything we're told about, you know, getting ahead in the world.
It does, doesn't it? We're bombarded with messages about winning, being the best, all that. But this chapter makes a really compelling case for cooperation being the key to personal fulfillment and societal progress.
But what about like healthy competition? I mean, don't we need that drive to push ourselves and, you know, achieve great things?
That's a great question. And it's justified using examples from nature, the survival of the fittest kind of logic, even though that's often a misapplication. The chapter pushes back on that competition is healthy mantra.
How so?
It suggests that while, yeah, competition might be part of how we figure things out, how we develop skills, cooperation is actually a more advanced, more beneficial stage of interaction.
More advanced. I like that.
And it mentions Pauline B. Rosenau questioning this whole fetishization of competition, even framing it potentially as a public health issue because of the stress and inequality it can drive.
A public health issue. It certainly permeates entertainment, sports. This in-group, out-group thinking.
Absolutely. It's everywhere. Chapter 4 argues that while competition might be part of the journey of understanding social value, it's not the destination.
So wait, are we essentially talking about a fear-based approach to self-worth versus a love-based approach?
I think that's a really powerful way to put it.
But honestly, I think a lot of people, myself included sometimes, struggle with letting go of that competitive mindset. Maybe it's not about giving up on striving for excellence altogether, but about making sure that fear and insecurity aren't the ones driving the bus, you know?
Exactly. It's about finding that sweet spot where you can still push yourself to grow and evolve, but without needing to prove yourself all the time.
Finding that inner peace, that confidence, that would be amazing.
It is amazing. And you know what? When you operate from that place of inner peace and confidence, it changes how you interact with others, too. It's like you're not trying to tear them down to build yourself up anymore. You're coming from a place of mutual respect and appreciation. You want everyone to succeed.
That sounds like a much healthier and more sustainable way to live, honestly. Instead of trying to beat others, it's about trying to be our best selves.
Ooh, got it. And the cool thing is, this shift in behavior, it doesn't just benefit others. It actually has a really powerful impact on your own sense of self-worth.
Or I see what you mean, because then your self-worth isn't based on external validation or comparing yourself to other people. It comes from knowing that you're, like, making a positive impact.
Yeah, you got it. It's a much deeper and more sustainable source of self-worth.
Okay, I like that. It's about contribution, not domination. It mentions the Harvard study acknowledging some data concerns, but agreeing on the principle and work by Dr. Julia Lee and Carol Dweck. The gist is positive reinforcement works way better than constant criticism.
The 5-to-1 ratio thing. 5 positives for every negative.
Something like that, yeah. In thinking about the emotional spectrum from the book, wouldn't that kind of leadership fall more on the love side?
Absolutely. Because it's about wanting to help others grow, right? Mm. Rather than coming from that fear of not being in control. That's where the book gets really practical. It provides some specific tools for, you know, navigating that whole journey.
Okay, I'm all ears. What kind of tools are we talking about?
Well, the chapter talks about this idea of cultivating a mindset of abundance.
Abundance.
Yeah. Instead of scarcity, like there's enough for everyone. My worth doesn't depend on me having more than you, you know? When you believe that, it can help you let go of that fear-driven need to compete.
I like that. Abundance over scarcity.
Taking the time to just, like, appreciate all the good things in your life, both big and small, it really helps you shift from that feeling of lack to a feeling of abundance. Like, I have enough. I am enough.
So instead of looking outward for validation, we need to, like, turn inward. Cultivate that self-acceptance and appreciation.
The book also talks about forgiving yourself.
The more we criticize ourselves, the more we need validation from other people, and the less we trust our own worth.
So self-forgiveness, it's crucial for breaking free from that cycle and extending the same compassion to yourself that you would offer to, I don't know, a close friend or a loved one. When you start practicing self-forgiveness, you naturally become more compassionate and understanding towards other people. It ripples outward, you know, it creates more harmonious relationships.
And it helps us strengthen our own self-worth in the process.
Chapter 4 also talks about the importance of humility.
Now, that one can be tricky. A lot of times, humility is seen as putting yourself down or, like, downplaying your accomplishments.
It's not about self-deprecation at all. True humility is about recognizing that we're all connected. It's about approaching life with a sense of gratitude and openness, knowing that we all have something to learn from each other, and that a lot of times our individual achievements, they wouldn't have been possible without the support and collaboration of other people. Chapter 4 also highlights the importance of curiosity. It really underscores how interconnected all these psychological challenges are, which is the whole point of unraveling the fabric of fear, isn't it?
Curiosity keeps us humble. It keeps us learning. It keeps us growing.
And that continuous growth, that's key for developing a healthy sense of self-worth. When you're constantly learning and evolving, you're less likely to get stuck in those rigid self-perceptions or need validation from other people, you know? Your self-worth becomes more rooted in your own unique journey of growth and discovery.
So it's like you're building your self-worth from the inside out instead of relying on external validation to hold you up.
Precisely. So as the chapter wraps up its main points, it brings in religion and spirituality.
Yeah, it briefly looks at how different traditions handle this whole quest for respect and self-worth. It provides a broader context.
Interesting. So, like, the Christian perspective, it mentions inherent worth, right? Like, from 1 John being loved and chosen by God, separate from social status.
Mm-hmm. And the whole love your neighbor as yourself idea from Matthew, which is fundamental to mutual respect.
And Islam. The Quran quote about the most noble being the most righteous.
Yeah.
Again, focusing on inner character, not social rank.
Right. And the hadith mentioned connects good character to being loved by both Allah and people linking the spiritual and the social.
Then there's Buddhism, focusing on self-development first, like in the Dhammapada, self-worth from inner work.
Yeah. And that concept of the self as awareness, not just the body or ego, shifts the focus inward again.
And Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita, talking about equanimity, being free from attachment and fear.
Yeah.
Qualities of inner strength, defining worth.
Exactly. Internal source again.
And it also mentions thinkers like Eckhart Tolle about getting beyond the ego.
Right. Suggesting that worth based purely on external stuff is kind of illusory.
It's like they all offer pathways to build a sense of worth that's less dependent on the shifting sands of perceived social opinion, directly addressing that core human tendency the chapter identifies at the start.
They offer alternative anchors.
Anchors, yeah, that's a good word. Anchors in inner principles or divine connection or self-awareness or detachment things less vulnerable to external opinion or competition.
Which leads us to a final thought for you to ponder.
If our perception of our own worth is so easily shaped by external forces, by advertising, by our own assumptions about what others think, what steps can you start taking right now to build a sense of self-worth that's a little less vulnerable? Something more grounded, more resilient to those outside pressures and manipulations.
When we see people actually living these principles in their own lives, mm-hmm. It inspires us to do the same. It shows us that this more love-based approach to social value, it's not just some pie-in-the-sky idea. It's actually possible.
And we all have the potential to be those role models for others, whether it's in our families, our workplaces, our communities, even online. It's about making a conscious choice to embody those principles of love, humility, and curiosity in everything we do. This deep dive into Chapter 4, it's really just the beginning. There's so much more to explore in unraveling the fabric of fear. And remember, true self-worth, it doesn't come from, you know, climbing some social ladder or getting to the top of the heap. It comes from recognizing the inherent value in everyone, including yourself, And that's a really powerful message to carry with you as you move through the world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Until next time, stay cool, stay kind to yourself, dive deep.